Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start out with emails, or rather reply, goes out to Sybil in SoCal, and Sybil was... Thank you, Sybil, for the information about 5G. I'll be working on some research and review on 5G. It's a complex topic, and I plan to call in all of my most scientific friends so that I can really present you with a rational viewpoint and possibly even some safety suggestions should that be deemed necessary. Sybil also has a question. She wants to know about her supplements. Why would she need them? She's 63 vegan, and she takes methyl B12, a bone formula supplement. Well, that's good for a 63-year-old female. Hopefully, it's got some vitamin K2 in there, a multivitamin. Also good because as we age, our absorption of nutrients deteriorates, particularly if we have if we use antacids or proton pump inhibitors. Often, probably one of the more commonly used drugs in that population for heartburn, and it does impair absorption of several important nutrients. She takes kelp. Well, iodine is good. I don't know how much iodine there is in your kelp. Unfortunately, they don't say on the label. Something that we might get into later in the show is labeling on natural products. But I generally consider that a level in women, particularly if you have a family history of breast cancer, a couple of milligrams of iodine are very safe, the only exception being certain kinds of hypothyroidism where you have to be more careful. Turmeric, I'm not much on turmeric because it's not very bioabsorbable. That means it'll help your tummy, but not much else, so I generally use curcumin, primarily as an anti-inflammatory in people who have inflammation, diabetes, or other issues, particularly if you have arthritis. That can be a very good agent. Doses around 500 milligrams of absorbable curcumin. Vitamin D, I think everybody should take vitamin D. I like to keep blood levels around 50 to 70, and I don't see those kinds of blood levels in people who are the usual indoor mall rats that we've all become. There's an article in this month's New Scientist, just came out last week, talking about how getting more daylight can optimize health, and talking about how we want to change the light temperature. So blue light in the morning, warm light, incandescent was actually a kind of a good idea, actually, who knew? But getting extra sunlight is not only good for your biorhythms and your sleep patterns, there's evidence that the inflammatory and immune cells actually notice whether photons are hitting them. And photons in daylight will actually penetrate your skin up to about a quarter of an inch. So an interesting thought that you might actually be affecting your lymphatics and other immune tissues by making sure they get adequate ultraviolet radiation. And honestly, I'm not sure that vitamin D does that job. And I do encourage people to sensibly get a little sun every day, at least on maybe your arms, and not be so frightened of the concept of sun. I think the sunscreen and the dermatologist group have maybe done us a disservice. Continuing on with Sybil's email, she asks about algae, DHA, EPA, because she's a vegan, and I think extra omegas are very, very useful. I think they are also anti-inflammatory. They help keep the lipids down. They've been shown to lower bad cholesterol. In fact, one study showed that high dose, I think they used about 4,000 milligrams of EPA DHA, worked as well as 10 milligrams of Lipitor. That study was never replicated, to my knowledge, and I can understand why. I expect that the funding... And maybe there was a little discouragement on the part of the makers of Lipitor, a major anti-cholesterol drug. But conspiracy speculations aside, I encourage the bottom line for someone over 60, take a multi. If you're female, take some extra calcium and vitamin K, take some omegas, and take some vitamin D3 with the threshold levels I mentioned, 50 to 70 as your goal. Why would a person need alpha-lipoic acid? Well, if you're a drinker, it's helpful in preserving your liver and preventing liver disease. It's also very useful in diabetics as both a treatment and a preventative for neuropathy, and it is an insulin sensitizer. So for people who are borderline or pre-diabetic, it can be very beneficial. Why take CoQ10? Well, that one's a little harder. The only people who have to take CoQ10 are people taking statins, and they should be taking, you know, at least a couple hundred milligrams of ubiquinol, because your statin drugs are going to deplete that, and you really want those levels high, because CoQ10 is important for energy generation. It's core to your mitochondria, and your mitochondria are core to your brain. So keeping those mitochondria healthy through exercise, proper diet, and making sure your CoQ10 levels are adequate is very important for healthy brain aging. And who knows how long you're going to live with all of this technology coming along. You know, it may be another century before you can upload into a hard drive, so you better take care of that body. Our last email for the moment is from Annie in Santa Cruz, and Annie wanted to know if I would talk about an article. This was, and I have the article right here. It was published in, looks like maybe the Atlantic, and why anti-vaccine doctors are ordering 23andMe tests. And the gist of the article is that information that's dating back almost 11 years, research done in the early days of genetic research, looking at MTHFR and IRF1, which is an interferon modulating gene, showed increased adverse events after smallpox vaccination. Oh, did you hear adverse effects and smallpox vaccination? Well, you're right. This nice, innocent scientific article, which really doesn't show all that much, except that if you have certain genetic variants after a vaccination, you're more likely to get a fever and a rash and lymph node swelling, which, guess what, is really common with smallpox vaccination. And you're more likely to get them if you have genetic predispositions to increased inflammation. And this is hardly big news, but apparently this is being used by some doctors to justify exempting people from vaccinations. And in fact, I did have an experience last year with a patient who wanted her children exempted from vaccines because the child had a heterozygous, that means one bad copy, of one of the MTHFR genes. Now, this is very common in the population. Something like 30% of the population might be heterozygous. One bad copy is really not a problem. Two bad copies, maybe, particularly if you have two bad copies of the same gene or two bad copies on the same chromosome, something that we can't figure out, by the way, when we're looking at 23andMe data, because it doesn't break it down by chromosome. What's important to understand is that the idea that genetics is sufficiently predictive at this point in the science to make a rational argument that a person should be exempted from vaccination is nonsense. At the most, and this is what I advise this patient, or mom of a patient, I should say, the vaccine should be spread out. If you're really worried about this, you separate them by a week. Let the person's immune system flare and attenuate, and then do it again. That way you'll get a strong but not an overly strong response. And in most cases, the adverse vaccine events are related to overly strong reactions, things like fever, sore arms, lymph nodes, and a very, very small number of people have adverse events, and some of those are just circumstantial. Honest to God, folks, I really feel that the measles MMR thing was bogus. It's not been substantiated by very careful research that I don't think was done by the pro-vaccine lobby, which I presume people mean the manufacturers. It was done by national governments because they don't really want to have to pay for autistic children. Hello? That's really expensive and it falls on them. So they have every reason to do careful research and refute the idea if it's wrong. And it's wrong. That doesn't stop there from being a whole lot of internet noise on the topic. And I want to thank you, Annie, for bringing this to my attention, because I think it's important to just put it out there and say, yeah, you know, not so much. Well, as you know, last week I ran a tape, and the reason I did that was because I was off in San Antonio, Texas. Yes, my friends, 90 degrees and 80% humidity. So that was fun, but the conference was really good. We learned about the focus was pain and functional medicine. But a great deal of the conference was dedicated to talking about opiate addiction and functional medicine strategies and other science around opiate addiction, and also just talking about alternatives to opiates. And top on the list there, something near and dear to ourselves here, is endocannabinoids. Now, if you want to bop in with an endocannabinoid question, I'll take it, and you can call 900-5773, or if you want to chime in with something during this next segment. But I am going to ask you to hold questions on other topics while I talk about this fascinating topic. Let's keep it coherent, if you please, and then we'll come back to any other topics and clean that up towards the end of the program. First of all, the way these things work is through a G-protein-coupled receptor. This is a fascinating little device that's, it sort of reminds me of the toys that you see on a children's Johnny Jump Up, or sometimes you'll see them on strollers. It's a bar with little, fun, you know, colorful shaped plastic things that spin around. Well, the G-protein receptor does exactly that. The endocannabinoids come along and, or cannabinoids, that's your THC and your CBD, touch the receptor. The receptor then spins, and a whole series of kind of Rube Goldberg devices go into line, and eventually it reaches the nucleus, and you get a change in what is being transcribed. So the cannabinoids are hitting two different receptors, CB1 and CB2. There's a long list of things that you get benefit for with the cannabinoids, literally from ADD, ALS, Alzheimer's, anorexia, anxiety, asthma, ataxia, bipolar, cachexia, we'll skip to the fourth column here, sickle cell anemia, spasm, spinal injury, stroke, Tourette's, and vomiting, and the entire alphabet in between. It's pretty amazing. And when you look at these things, they primarily fall into a couple of categories: immunological and pain and anxiety. So let's talk about these two receptors. You find a lot of CB1 receptors in the brain where it's actually inhibitory, and I'll explain what I mean by that. In the liver and fat cells, it promotes fat storage. CB2, on the other hand, you find in the spleen and the immune cells, especially beta cells, those are the ones who make antibodies, T cells, macrophages, and most importantly, microglia. So there may be a place for the endocannabinoids in helping people with dementia and Parkinson's disease. That's being studied as we speak. Oddly enough, you've all heard of prostaglandins. The endocannabinoids come from arachidonic acid. In other words, they're derived from the cell membrane in a very analogous process to the way that the prostaglandins are derived, by a series of enzymatic steps. And another interesting thing about them as neurotransmitters are concerned, is they are not held in vesicles. Normally in neurons, the transmitters are made and they're stored in these little bubbles called vesicles. And then when there's an electrical surge that depolarizes the neuron, these vesicles fuse with the cell wall of the neuron and are released into the synaptic space. But instead, the endocannabinoids are released at a low level, what's called a tonic level. And when they are when more are needed, the synthesis is amped up. So they're on-demand signaling. And the degradation is the highly regulated step. So these things are always sitting in the synapse, in other words, at a low level. And then how long they hang around, which is the degradation step, is where you see the most control. That's where the steering wheel is on this. Both GABA neurons and glutamate neurons. So GABA is the inhibitory relaxed neuron, and glutamate is the excitatory NMDA neuron. And both of these have presynaptic CB1. So what that means is that this anandamide, which is ethanolamide, this is the one that I said was tonically being released at a low level all the time, is like just putting its brake on the activity of these neurons at all times. And the inhibitory neuron, the GABA neuron, has more receptors for CB1. So when you smoke pot or use any kind of cannabis product, you're getting external THC and CBD. They jump onto these CB1 receptors. And particularly in the case of THC, they inhibit the relaxation. So you get a kind of euphoria. That's the high that goes along with THC. And so it's made postsynaptically, and it feeds back presynaptically. So this is just really, really an intriguing mechanism. And it's involved from rat studies. We know it's involved in reward. Here's another super interesting thing. Corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRF. This is the thing that causes, that your hypothalamus puts out, and it causes your pituitary gland to release ACTH, and that causes your adrenal gland to excrete cortisol. But corticotropin-releasing hormone is also released at low levels throughout the brain, and it regulates the breakdown of anandamide. So if you get an increase in corticotropin-releasing factor, that is to say you get more something that's stimulating stress, you're going to actually get less of the suppressor, and the brain will get more excitable and more easily excitable. And it varies by region, but in the amygdala, in the fear center, the stress and the excitation that is going on that is related to the CRF is actually going to lower the threshold for fear and anxiety. So this is just fascinating how the adrenal glands are connecting to the brain, and how the brain itself is modulating its own internal behavior region by region in different ways. So this receptor has been studied extensively. The periaqueductal gray, which is a part of the brain that I studied really well, have already done a lot with, is back in, before even medical school, that was my area. I was looking at how opiates affected the periaqueductal gray. And we were stimulating endorphins using little electrodes implanted in brains. Please don't kill me. I've reformed. I will never do rat work again. But I was young and naive and scientific. So getting back to away from the mea culpa and back to the science, what the PAG, or periaqueductal gray, does is it controls the inhibitory endorphins. So if I hit the CB1 receptor, I'm going to stimulate the release of endorphins, and I'm going to reduce pain at the spinal cord level. Because the endorphins, and the enkephalins, get in there and they change the threshold for the pain neurons to fire. So it literally takes more pain signal from your sore finger to aggregate and collect like a mob pounding on the door of a building before the door will burst open and the pain signal will actually make it to the brain. So this is an analgesic effect, and this is part of how it works. So this pot is analgesic through raising the levels of enkephalins and endorphins in the spinal cord and in the bloodstream. It's also really important in recovering after stress. It's also really important. It also contributes to stress-induced relapse to drug seeking. More about that later, because that's an interesting bimodal effect. It reduces anxiety directly, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's a rebound effect, and many of us may have experienced that. The breakdown enzymes, primarily FAAH, can be inhibited, and that can strengthen the effects of the basal tone of endocannabinoid release. So in an interesting sort of going around of the problem with airline pilots can't use THC, we don't really want bus drivers maybe using THC, it's possible that the pharmaceutical industry may eventually come up with ways of making your endogenous anandamide, which is the THC equivalent, last longer and work harder. There is a case study, this woman that was found, I think I might have mentioned her a couple of shows ago, but she is genetically has this super low pain threshold, and she has not got the enzyme to break down into anandamide. So whether she smokes pot or not, she's forgetful. But she also has very low anxiety, very low pain, and she's missing fatty acid amide hydrolase, which is the really key enzyme here. So that was the science. Now let's talk a little bit about some other interesting things about the CB receptors. And this is my favorite of all of the things that I learned about the CB1 receptor. You can't kill yourself by suffocation with marijuana, no matter how concentrated, no matter how big a pace, no matter how much you flood the CB1 receptor, you can't kill yourself. This is not true for Valium, and this is not true for opiates. So the Valium drugs, the benzodiazepines, suppress the respiratory center. My friends, this is no bueno. The opiates suppress the respiratory center, hence the need for all of that naloxone that is being put away. And I'm going to take a moment and digress on the subject of naloxone, because there's a bill right now in California, and I'm sorry, I don't think I have the number of the bill, but what's important about this is that it would allow pharmacists to prescribe naloxone, So do you imagine that people who are drug addicts have difficulty accessing healthcare? And do you imagine that people who maybe have a son or a daughter that they has had an opiate problem and they're concerned that they might start using again and they want to be able to handle an overdose if one occurs in the house? Do you think it might not be such a bad idea if loved ones, family and friends of people who are using could have some naloxone, could get it without a prescription for themselves? And in fact, I think it would be a really good idea. And there is legislation right now in committee in the state of California looking at exactly like that. Just a few statistics. The overall monthly rate of fatal overdose in between 2005 and 2016 was 0.6 per 100,000. That's a disease. You know, that's the sort of thing that the CDC looks at. And the rate of overdoses is going way, way up over the last year because, well, last few years, while opiate prescribing is going way, way down, but it isn't making a dent in the death rate because of the illicit fentanyl. So we need to get that naloxone out there, not just in the hands of police officers, but in the hands of citizens. So coming back to fun facts about the endocannabinoids, now that you know what CB1 receptor is, this is a fantastic system because it works at the descending pain system, but it also works on the ascending. There are CB1 receptors in the periphery. And what we see is we see that it impacts the ascending sensory neuron, and it hyperpolarizes it. So remember what I said about the crowd beating on the door to get in? Well, it takes more pain to even send a signal to the spinal column, and at the same time, it takes more signals at the spinal level to even send a signal to the brain. It blocks glutamate in the ascending pathway, and it has multiplicative, that's not just additive, but if you've got some opiates on board and you add the CB1, you get a multiplicative, synergistic effect greater than additive. And here's a couple of things, fun facts. Exercise doubles the levels of anandamide, and singing works even better. So if you get together with friends and sing, that's going to raise your endocannabinoids. And I think raise your voices to raise those endos. We're going to take a break for a moment just so I can remind you that this is KSQD Santa Cruz, and we are here on the beautiful Monterey Bay beaming to you, and we hope that you will listen to all of our programs. You can go to ksqd.org and see what's going on. We are listener-supported exclusively with a few grants, as you see, from local businesses, and we would love for your local business to advertise with us, and we'd love for you to give us a donation at kusp.org. So I think I've done my duty. Let's get back to fun facts. Ice bathing. You know those places? When I was in San Antonio, I saw some franchise that was making us do what we really want to do, which is bathe in ice water. And so let me tell you that ice bathing, even short-term immersion, raises your CB1 level, and it may increase your brown fat. So let's think about the dosing here, because that's really what I wanted to know. And that was something I learned at the conference very, very well, dosing for this. So in an Israeli study, it is a really impressive study, so I'll just break it down for you. These were people who were using opiates for pain, and they were given 20 grams per month of cannabis. So basically, let's see, one joint is 20% cannabis, and even one joint of 5% cannabis increased the effectiveness of oxycodone. And so even at subtherapeutic doses, at minuscule doses of THC, and it is primarily THC that's having this effect, you get a really substantial change in the effectiveness of opioids. So combining them is a really good idea. In this Israeli study, which I want to get back to, they had 20 grams per month of cannabis, and that was it. That didn't do anything else. And at the 7-month mark, 44% of the people had been able to discontinue their opiates, and they were just getting their pain control from their cannabis. And I have done I've done interviews and evaluations for the court on patients. And one recent case, this was a person with spinal cord trauma who used cannabis for pain successfully. He had, that was what controlled his pain. And we needed to establish for the court that this was a legitimate use. Cannabis doesn't, when you're using cannabis, you're going to get both THC and CBD in it. The lecturer that I thought was very persuasive, who's been working with medical marijuana for about 10 years, I think he was either from Maine or one of the other one of those other states over there on the right coast. Sulak is his name. He was talking about not using CBD for sleep. He said that if you take more than 15 milligrams of CBDC, you'd need to cause wakefulness. It's not helpful. So he suggests THC and CBD at about a 50-50 ratio. Another thing he pointed out was that dose is important. If you get the dose too high, however, you lose the sleep effects. So that has to do with these complex feedback loops that we've been talking about. And by the way, for those people who are just going for the bigger and bigger and bigger high with the super concentrated pastes and things, this is a really good way to downregulate CB1 and have your body stop making as many receptors. So this is just a race to the bottom, and you don't want to go there, because if you knock out your CB1 receptors, you're going to have, well, let's just say, a really bad year or two until they come back. So his suggestion is tincture or oil for new users, starting dose, tincture or oil, 1 to 2 milligrams of THC and CBD, and this is at a 1-to-1 ratio, 3 times a day, or if you're using vapor, and he does not like vape pens. He was very clear that we don't have good data about what's in that stuff, and obviously it's burning. It's not vaporizing. Using something like a volcano or other vaporizers, that nut does not heat up to combustion temperature, and it's combustion products that cause the damage. And let's not kid ourselves. Joints damage the lungs. The equivalent I've seen in the literature is that one joint, because the difference in the way it smoked, is at least a half a pack of cigarettes in terms of the damage to the tissues. So he starts out with a 1-to-1 ratio of these two things, goes up slowly. He tracks and documents responses. You're going after pain. You're going after sleep. Those are the strategies that you want to do. But there's some other non-psychoactive strategies. Using very low dose seems to make a THC, this low dose therapeutic dose I was talking about, was very beneficial in augmenting the effects of other painkillers. Something else I learned that was just super exciting for me was the effect of acidic cannabinoids. You see, the actual cannabinoids that are in the plant, the marijuana plant, are acidic. So they're a carboxylic acid form, and that they don't become the actual THC and CBD until they're heated. But the acidic raw cannabinoids appear to have a completely different effect, and they're highly anti-inflammatory. And so I learned about this wonderful recipe for using them for tea. And what he said was to take a pea-sized amount of bud and drop it in hot water and let it steep with some mint or something like that. And it was beneficial to help with arthritis. And it's not acting on the CB1 receptors because it works in animals where the CB1 receptor has been knocked out. It's still a potent anti-inflammatory taken that way. And I know a number of people who eat the bud, and I thought that was pretty weird and wondered why one would do that. But all of the people who've told me about this have been older and people who probably have arthritis. So we've talked about dosing. We've talked about other effects. In older people, dry mouth can really be a problem. And so calamus root and other kinds of lozenges are what he suggests. Let's go back to non-psychoactive strategies. Well, I've said that he doesn't like sleep. So let me take a moment here and go back to the idea of using it in opiate withdrawal, because that was, or rather, opiate use. This is something I plan to implement with my patients who are on opiates, because I tend to be fairly strict. I am not I'm not a nut, and I don't say to patients, oh, I don't prescribe opiates. I think that's an abdication of responsibility for a primary care physician. These are useful agents, and they need to be used properly. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. I'm going to get on my soapbox for a moment and just say that I saw an article about how as doctors have become penalized, punished, and intimidated into not giving opiate prescriptions. And I will say the punishment is coming in the multi-specialty groups, the large groups, where the administrators have basically, they're afraid of a lawsuit, so they discourage doctors from treating pain. And this is like a complete about face from, 15 years ago when they were afraid of a lawsuit, so they encourage doctors to treat pain. Yeah, you know, that's the problem when you live too long. You get to see the pendulum swing a few too many times. Anyway, a drug, gabapentin, has had a huge surge in prescriptions, and it's being given for chronic back pain, musculoskeletal pain, migraine, all kinds of things that it wasn't previously given for. And there's a good reason that it wasn't being used for those things, because there's no actual data that shows that it works. In fact, there's considerable data that shows it probably doesn't work for most of these indications. It is a nerve suppressing agent that is good for nerve-based pain, like herpes zoster pain from shingles. But it is not, and it's good for seizures, but it's not good for other kinds of pain, and it doesn't work, and it's been shown to not work, but it'll get the patient out of your office. This is crazy, and we need to stop that. Overall, what I was intrigued with on the subject of opiate use was the idea of clock watching, because one of the things that happens is people, maybe they've got three Vicodin a day. That's how many their doctor lets them have. They've got an allowance. They've got enough to get to the through the month as long as they don't use more than is on their list. But, you know, it starts to be a little early. You're in the bathroom. You know, wash your hands. You see the pill and you think, well, it's a little early, but I really would like, I'm starting to feel a little pain. I'd really like to take it. But, you know, it's not time yet. And so you get into this clock watching phenomenon, which is a real problem, because people are starting to get anxiety around not taking the medication. And then they start to have a dopamine response when they take it. And the last thing in the world you want is a reward response from your opiate, because that's the primrose path into addiction. So it's been shown to really help with this clock watching. It takes your mind off of the fact that you're hurting a little now and your pill's not due till 1 o'clock and it's noon. And so you take a little THC, CBD combination, and you kind of get distracted and forget about it and go do something else. And before you know it, it's 1:30 and it's like, oh, woohoo, I even made it past the time. Well, maybe I'll wait till 2 and see how I'm feeling at 2. And this is why 44% of the people in that Israeli study got off of their opiates, because the people in pain, they don't have a positive association about this. The people who get the addiction are the people who have other issues, which is many of us who also have pain. And they feel good. They feel better than they felt in years. They feel good. They're not. It's not that they're taking away their pain. It's that they feel good. And that's the group that is so vulnerable. We listened to a speech by one such person, person who was a very, very high-performing doctor who started to get into trouble with opiates while finishing residency, and then went on faculty and managed to be a very high-functioning faculty of the year, best-performing professor, all the while going up and up and up and up on his opiate use. But he had access to clean drug, and he kept it under wraps, well, sort of under wraps. But ultimately, it's not a good path, and everyone has to step back from it sooner or later, or they're going to get into a serious situation. Looks like we've got time for another email, so I'm going to go to, this is a fairly long one, from Carl in San Francisco, and I'm not going to read Carl's entire email, but basically he's 67, he's a vegan, and he exercises and he's gotten older, he's developed more post-nasal drip and sinus issues. As a child, he had bronchitis, borderline asthma. Now he's got some rhinitis. And so he thought he'd try using a neti pot. And he kind of misunderstood my discussion of using a neti pot for chronic sinusitis. But he did the treatment, and he was very thoughtful and careful about the way he did it. But I think as I look at the issue, I think that he assumed he treated himself for an infection that he didn't have. And so he had some irritation from the digestive enzyme dose. He used a somewhat high dose of digestive enzymes, and he dissolved it into the neti pot. And actually, a better way to use digestive enzymes if you're trying to break up a biofilm is actually to take them orally. And I may have to go back and look, obviously the podcast has gone out, but I may have to go back and modify that and drop in an additional caution that the digestive enzymes are to be taken orally on an empty stomach at bedtime if you have chronic sinusitis. The silver is going into the neti pot and being used to rinse the sinuses. So, Carl, I believe that I will send you an email and have you take the digestive enzymes out of your neti pot, and I think that's going to help out with the difficulties that you've been having. We learned a lot about chronic pain, and one of the really interesting lectures, probably the most interesting lecture after the cannabinoid work, was by a guy named Moosnick talking about chronic pain. And his point is that any time a person has been in constant pain for more than 8 weeks, and the pain has become widespread, in other words, above and below the waist, and on the right and the left side of the body, then you have a pain processing problem. You don't just have pain, you have a problem with how your brain is starting to sense the pain. And that's because your brain has gotten trained to pain. And so what he suggests doing is drawing a picture and having your patients draw a picture of their pain. And one of the problems with the use of narcotics in chronic widespread pain, and it is a very bad idea, is that because of the way narcotics work, they are going to cause downregulation of the receptors potentially, and that's going to increase sensitization. So the central pain processing issue will get worse, plus you're very likely to give them gastrointestinal problems. And narcotics lower testosterone and estrogen. And estrogen is, among other things, a natural anti-inflammatory. So let's count it up. You're going to increase brain pain sensitivity as you rebound off the opioids. You're going to decrease your estrogen and therefore your natural anti-inflammatory, ditto for the testosterone in men. And because you slow down gastric transport, you're likely going to cause small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is going to cause abdominal distension, and you're going to get constipation as well as a bonus symptom. So it is really important to address widespread diffuse pain differently. So he had lots of strategies, but the important thing is to always assess the adrenals and the mitochondria whenever there's any chronic pain. And he was very, very, Moosnick wanted to talk about histamines and how big a deal histamines are in aggravating pain. So quercetin, luteolin, and glucosamine, which is a mast cell stabilizer, all lower histamine release. Quercetin dosing, that's in apple skins and onion skins, but I like the capsules, maybe 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day. The dose on the luteolin, you can get that in certain combo bioflavonoid pills, but he said eat a quarter of a head of radicchio every day. So radicchio is that red cabbage-looking thing, but it's small and more bitter and apparently chocked full of luteolin. He also recommended dietary manipulation, which is to say a high alkaline diet. That's all kinds of fruits and vegetables and less meat and more and less sugar. Less meat, less sugar, more veggies, more fruit, more whole grains, but not too many and no ground up whole grains because that'll raise the insulin. Now, he wanted to make the point that these receptors have lots and lots of things that hit them. Prostaglandins, histamine, 5-HT, bradykinin, acidic pH. And if person's kind of sore all over, you've got to keep the glutamate low and you've got to keep the mast cells down. So what can you do to keep glutamate low? Well, one thing you can do is stay away from NutraSweet and aspartame, because that's a sweetener in a whole lot of quote-unquote health foods. It's also very high in gum. So even L-glutamate, which I often prescribe to people, I'm going to think twice now if you have a issue. Now, I think some of you might have misunderstood me. It is luteolin. That's like the medieval instrument, the lute. And so it's not gluteolin. I had a question there pop up on my screen. So what can you do as well? Those enzymes I was mentioning, turns out that on an empty stomach at least, trypsin and chymotrypsin, which are found in digestive enzymes, are actually mediators and help reduce pain. So what do you want to do? Well, you want to reduce histamine, so check out for those food allergies. You want to use an anti-inflammatory diet, curcumin, boswellia. You want to think about resveratrol because it blocks the cytokines, especially tumor necrosis factor alpha. And you want to avoid accelerated glycolic end products. So that, my dear friends, is found in grilled meat and grilled vegetables. Isn't that sad? I love my grilled vegetables, but if I'm having pain, I should know that it might make it a little bit worse. So maybe I want to avoid doing that because I'm in pain and I don't need to be upregulating my pain. Now, another thing that these are all like little pearls that I just felt like I was collecting them in a jewel box to use for patients and also to share with you. If a person is having generalized pain, stop taking calcium. Instead, take some magnesium. I usually use magnesium glycinate, about 1,000 milligrams spread out over 3 doses, give or take. But dextromethorphan, which is found in cough syrup, sedates the NMDA receptors in the central cord. So with chronic diffuse pain, if you've done all of the things and you're not getting anywhere, something to think about doing is to add dextromethorphan. And that was certainly exciting to me. So another tidbit is, as we're just doing a whole bunch of pearls here today in the wind up at the end of the show, talking about the functional medicine conference I attended and all the great little tidbits for pain I came back with, is topical testosterone all over tendonitis. And I have a little Achilles tendinopathy, and thanks, a big shout out to Ronning Physical Therapy for their help in teaching me exercises, which have turned it around beautifully. Thank you very much, Mitch and friends. But a little topical testosterone. So if your husband's using topical testosterone, ladies, you might grab a little, sub a pea size amount, pinole amount, a little pine nut size amount, and rub it on the tendon. Men, you can do this too. And if you're applying your testosterone in the normal places, take the rest of your hand and rub it on that sore tendon. I am N of one and could be placebo, but it seems to be helping. So it certainly won't hurt. Glucosamine sulfate, also very good for joint arthritis. And again, we had mentioned proteolytic enzymes because they do reduce joint inflammation. And it's intriguing that they would, but they definitely do. Muscle pain. First of all, check the joints. Much of muscle pain is actually coming from joints. Referred pain, we call that. But if indeed it is muscle pain, 20% magnesium sulfate in a cream, and I think that can be compounded. I'm not sure if you even need a prescription for it, but I'll certainly be talking to the local compounding pharmacies, one compounding pharmacy up in Scotts Valley and Loudoun over on 41st Avenue, and making sure that they mix some up, because I'm hoping that there will be a run on the market after this podcast goes out. Exercise is super important. So even if you have pain, exercise what you can. Try pool exercise. Try exercising in bed. Try stretching. But exercise actually resets the pain threshold, and it's important to avoid it. Other things important to avoid, I think I mentioned aspartame, that's equal earlier. That's a sugar substitute. But MSG, and you can go search online and find all of the things that contain MSG that don't sound like MSG. It's in a truckload. In fact, probably the majority of snack foods contain MSG because it makes the food taste good and it makes it slightly addictive. But it also is an excitotoxin, so it's going to make pain worse. And we just have to take a deep breath and think about, do we really want to do that? I just don't think so. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.